Before the moment's silence, I'm going to say 23 names of those no longer with us. Tom G, Walter, Jesse, Jimmy A, Ron G, MS John, SAS Angry John, Babs, Michael Kevin, Fireman Colin, Tall Mark, Taxi Gary, Wee Adam, Martin the Monk, Lockkeeper Joe, Young Maidenhead Mark, America John, Vera from Newbury, Melvin, Sheila from Bracknell. The next three names are close to three of our speakers today. Eve of Henley for Mick, Barry of Wantage, Anne's husband, Pat of Twyford, Terry's close friend. These are just a few names of many who we today owe a great debt of gratitude.
Thank you. I'm now going to hand over to our first speaker, quoting from Bill Shakespeare. We few, we happy few, we band of Elkies, for them today that share with us shall be our old timers. So over to you, Mick, who I think got sober here in the rectory over there of Watlington House, back when you were a strapping young lad. Over to you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name's Mick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mick.
This place is kind of special to me because this is the rectory over there is where I got sober. When I first joined AA, I didn't like it. I didn't like people. Because they were like my enemy because they wanted me to stop drinking. Really, I didn't. You know, and that was, my sobriety day is the 24th of the 12th, 75. And, I best tell you a bit about how I got sick and then I can tell you how I got well. I believe, ism ran in our family, because when I was a kid, I was in more trouble with the police, than I was when I was drinking. I grew up in a rough area, and I had a front, a tough guy, you know, but inside me was a soft, kind person. But where we lived, you couldn't show it. You know, it used to be called Blood and Gut Street. And, and Henley did have a slum, and that's where we were. We lived. And, I didn't do all that well at school because I didn't get involved in anything. Oh, the only things I got involved with was art, animals, and such like. Because I love the countryside, and I love animals. And, when it came to leaving school, all I was told by the teacher was, you know, all you're fit for is to be a farmer. And I thought, well, nothing wrong with that. I'd like to be a farmer. And, I went to work on the forestry commission, which I loved. I took my dog, me guns, me ferrets. And I thought it was the job of a lifetime. But I got the sack because I didn't keep the time, people. I was late in the morning and left early. I got it back to front. And, so they sacked me. And I went to work at a brewery as a mechanic, as an apprentice mechanic. And I'm grateful today that I did go there because what it done for me was got me to where I was heading quicker. It was a wet brewery. We could drink all day. There was a bar open. Bar sounds a bit posh for it. All it was a small tap room with two barrels up and a case of minerals. I worked over the stables. That bar was the other side, the drinking area. And the two guys I worked with were heavy drinkers. When I first went there, I was only 15. And so they wouldn't let me have a drink. But as soon as they went out of sight, I searched the stables for their stash. And I took my first drink, and it changed me from a frightened child into what I thought was a man. And I chased that compulsion every time I took a drink. As time went on, I was allowed to drink openly with them. And I aimed to be a big drinker, and I succeeded. I was a big head with my drinking. I drank in competitions, fastest pint, yard of ale. We used to have a pub open over the bridge, the Carpenters. And if you could drink a glass boot, it was 4.5 pints without taking it away from your mouth. You didn't have to pay for it. So when I didn't have much money, well, I never had money because I was an apprentice. My mother had a certain amount, and the rest was supposed to be for clothes, but I spent it on guns and beer. And there was no way I had a problem there, but if I was going to parties or anywhere, I always went to the pub first and drank, because I couldn't go anywhere without drink inside me, because I thought I was frightened, of meeting people. I couldn't talk to girls. Actually, alcohol took away my virginity, because if I'd never drank, I would have never lost it, because I couldn't talk to girls. And so that's one good thing. But the only thing it took away, or gave me, was lust. Like booze, I love sex, I used and abused, not abused, but like we call it today, I used women, I didn't have many steady girls because of the drinking. I never took a girl to the pictures because they didn't have a bar in there. If I took a girl to a dance, I stayed at the bar. And I became a beatnik because I liked their style. I liked the music. Beatniks were before hippies. I didn't like hippies a lot because they had bells and all the jingles and jangles. And I got involved with a group of beatniks from London. And we used to go around in groups. And we'd go to all the festivals, set up our communes and bars. And I've been to lots of festivals with lots of famous people. And I've never actually seen a stage. Because as soon as I got there, I would head for the bar. And that's where I was, the bar or the commune. And that's how I was with booze. I was controlled. My father used to say to me, we didn't have a phone, so I used to have to use a phone box. You're the only bloke I ever known that would go to make a phone call and come back drunk. And that's what I used to do. I'd just go and phone a girl or phone somebody, and then I'd go off to the pub only for a drink. And I'd come back drunk. I remember my first bad drunk, and that was, my brothers were keen on army stuff, and they were in the TA, and I went there with them one night, drinking and playing cards, and I remember going down the toilet to go to wee, and I felt a bit giddy, so I went and washed my face, and all of a sudden, I was looking up at the ceiling, and the sink up there, so, and I must have just went backwards and fell on the floor. Friend of mine, he found me, stuck my head in the water and that, and then took me home. And it was a freezing night. And all my hair was frozen. You know? That was my first drunk. But it never put me off. You know? I got used to it. You know, at work, as time went on, you know, I met a girl at Christmas, New Year's Eve. And she became my wife in the end. She didn't see anything different to my drinking than the crowd I knocked around with. Because they drank, I drank like they did, they drank like I did. She found me very exciting. She calls me a dull old fart now. But she found me exciting, and because I had long hair, I wore Russian boots, and it was a like kind of an in-crowd person in our group of life. I knew where all the parties were, through the beatniks, and that we partied lots. We slept out rough. When I used to go to the Il Pie Island, we used to stay the night. Not Sylvia, but she used to go home, and she had more sense. And we'd sleep out in the parks and the graveyards, things like that. And, you know, that's how my life was. Booze gradually began taking things away from me, but I never noticed it. People were at the brewery were warning me, the old folks, and I thought that they were jealous of me because I was young, you know. And we could drink from 4 o'clock in the morning till about 6 to 7 when the pubs opened, and we could go into the pubs. And that. There was a pub next door to the brewery. We got married, and Sylvia, on the day we got married, she said to me, "Please, Mick, don't drink so much today. It's a special day." And I didn't. So there must have been a problem then, and it only got worse. See, Sylvie lived in London and I lived in Henley, and a lot of her, so she didn't see a lot of my drinking until we got married. And then I was coming home from work drunk. She put it down to living with my mother while we were waiting for to get a house. She put it down to the men I worked with and the brewery. And I allowed her because it took all the guilt away from me. Then, you know, as things went on, we had a child. My drinking seemed to be under control of it, you know, for a while, but it gradually crept back. We had a flat, alcoholic's paradise, because next door was a pub, a back garden went into the yard I worked on, in, opposite the brewery. So booze was there 24 hours a day. We had booze indoors, but I didn't drink indoors much, very rarely. I didn't let Sylvie see exactly how much I drank. But there was nothing wrong with my drinking, because I hid bottles. Our toilet was one flight of stairs down, and I would say to Sylvie, "I'm just going to the toilet." And I'd go down, then I'd run downstairs, run out of our back garden, into the pub next door, have a couple of quick doubles, and run back and pretend I'm in the toilet. I had booze all over the house. Then we bought a house, and you know, money was short. So again, my drinking was controlled by money. And after a while, I got involved with some people in the wine and spirits, selling booze, stolen booze. I would sell it for them, they'd get it out and give me it, and I would go round and sell it for them. Sylvie asked me one day where I was getting all my money from, and I said, "Oh, I work lunchtimes doing private work." And she said, you can't be. You come home to dinner. So I stopped coming home. You know, stopped coming home dinner times. You know, I bolted the gate, the door after the horse has bolted. That's my life. You know, but, you know, I cheated for alcohol. As time was going on, it was out of control. People were at work, were warning me. Sylvie was fed up with the drinking, you know, because I'd come home drunk every day, either from work or I'd come home drunk most of the time. Wherever I was, I couldn't be no further away, not far from drink. If I opened a bottle of whiskey in my head and whiskey in my house, I couldn't leave it. I'd have a drink, go out of the room and think, what happens if somebody delays me? So I'd go back in that room and have another drink. I hid bottles all over the house. I remember once I hid a flat half in the jacket on the airing cupboard. And our house was a terrace house with a kitchen on the back, a little hallway and a bathroom. And I went through the kitchen. Sylvie was working in the kitchen. I went into the hall where the airing cupboard was, opened it, grabbed the bottle and had a quick slug, and it was red hot. And I couldn't shout out because Sylvie was next door. But, you know, things... I took on allotment, you know, because I had ferrets. That's why I'm called Mick the Ferret, is because I had ferrets. And the shed they were in fell down, so I bought a nice big shed and I kept them there. And I used to keep my booze in there. And every time it seemed I went out to get a drink, Sylvie would walk past the window there and catch me. And we used to play games in our house. It was called Follow the Leader and Hide and Seek. I would hide bottles, Sylvie would see them. I would go in a room, Sylvie would follow me. You know, and so I got this allotment. Today, I do not know which is my allotment. I know where they are, but I don't know which was mine. And all I ever done over the allotment was drink and bury the bottles. And none grew. Not one of those bottles grew. On this day I came home, I'd had too much to drink, and Dad and Mum was down for the weekend, and there was a terrific argument between me and my father-in-law. And I said to Sylvie, I'm an alcoholic, Sylvie. That's why. And I'm going to seek help. I'd known a year before, because if there's any paperwork, anything in the papers mentioning alcoholism, anything on the telly, we were sitting in the room, and the telly, they were talking about alcoholism or alcoholics. I turned the telly over so that she could identify me with one. And I went up to see the doctor, and he'd never dealt with one, so he gave me some Valium, vitamin B injection, and we made appointments for the same time every week. And what I used to do, I used to go to work, drink at work, till I thought I was a normal person. The shakes would go, and then I'd go and see the doctor, and he would ask me how I was, and I would tell him a load of lies. I hadn't had a drink, or things like that, or I had had a drink, you know, but not much. So he'd give me vitamin B injections, some more Valium, and I'd go from there, across the road to the pub, down to our off license, steal a bottle of whiskey, back to the garage, and I'd come home by lunchtime drunk. Sylvie would phone him and say, he's drunk again. And he couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe it. And that's how I was. You know, I stole, lied, cheated for alcohol. And anyway, there must have been another argument, because he gave me a phone number. There must have been another upset in our home, and I phoned two people, AA, I think I phoned, Sylvie might have done it, I don't know, I was drunk. Two people from AA visited me. One was called Tom Rennie, I think, and someone did tell me the other guy, and I can't remember. It could have been Tommy G, I don't know. Anyway, they visited me, I didn't even know they'd been. And Eve contacted me, and she took me to my first meeting. It was March, in March anyway, end of 75. Sylvie was heavily pregnant with a baby. She was supposed to go into hospital on the day I came to my meeting, first meeting, and she wouldn't go because she wanted to make sure I went to the meeting. And I went with Eve. I drove. Eve didn't drive. I had a wonderful. I'm a mechanic, and I had a wonderful car. It was a white Vauxhall. As you drove it along the road, all the lights used to go off. You thumped the dashboard, they'd come on. You know, it was a wreck. I was drunk, and poor old Eve, I don't know if she ever put, she really had someone looking after her up there. And, you know, I went to my first meeting, I listened to you people, and I thought, I've got your problem. You know, you don't know me. I'm different. You know, I drink more than you for my breakfast. You know, all stuff like that. I've been trying just not to say, you know. I've said, you know, so many times now. I give up. And it was every meeting I went to, I had booze in me. I used to think I'd cut down on the drinking before coming to AA, but I didn't. I sat in that little room back over there in Wadlington House, behind the upright. I always sat behind there looking round. I saw all the people sober, and I never wanted what they had. You know, they was old for a start. I was 29. They were old. And they were talking of 30 and 40 years of drinking. I'd only done 14. I was robbed. So I drank for another 5 months, and things just went worse and worse. Sylvie left me. We had a little daughter. Sylvie left me because she feared for her own sanity. On one of these nights, at Wallington House, they used to get films from Upper Hayford Air Base. And they used to come into this little room here, and we used to show them. And Sylvie had come with me to see the film, and it was Talk Chalk. And as I sat there with her, she kept nudging me, saying, "Do you understand that? Did you hear that? Did you do all these things?" You know, and someone saw her. It was Michael Kevin, as we knew him as Kevin. He changed his name, Michael Kevin. And after the film, he came up to Sylvie and he talked to her. He introduced Sylvie to his wife, and they talked for a while, and Sylvie joined Al-Anon. That was on Monday nights. And the meetings were Wednesday and Friday. And, you know, I thought, great, she's in Al-Anon now. I can drink, because she'll have to accept me drinking like that, because she's going to her meetings, you know. And anyway, it got worse. She left. I thought she'd just, you know, gone away for, like she was going away. It didn't, you know, it didn't even affect me in the head. I just thought, oh, well, she'd be back. And she didn't. She didn't come back. And then one day I woke up and I'd had enough of drinking. I I made a nuisance of myself when she was away, because I used to go up drunk up to her mum's and cause chaos up there. Everywhere I went, I'd cause chaos. You know, and anyway, I went up, I woke up and I'd had enough. I couldn't remember my last drink. I couldn't remember where I'd been for quite a while, you know, quite a few days. I phoned up my boss and I told him that I wasn't ever coming back to work because the state I was in. He turned up at my house with his wife. A doctor turned up at my house. And Sylvie turned up at my house on that day. And I ended up in a locked ward in Littlemore, BA it was called. And I even in there, I thought I was special and different. Because everyone was sectioned there, and I thought I wasn't. I thought I went involuntary. You know. I reached another rock bottom in there, and they allowed me out, but I wasn't allowed to live at Henley. I had to go and stay in London with Sylvie's mum. And she had my Everin. Is that it?
Everin.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. I can't say. And I was trying to get that offer earlier and earlier every day, because, you know, it used to make me feel good. The Valium I used to have, I used to take by the handful, because I didn't have booze. Anyway, all I was away from a little more for a while was, well, they got a bed for me in the clinic. It was, they call them clinics and that now, you know, when Lee wasn't that good. Anyway, I went in there for a month, and I didn't involve myself in anything. Someone told me that, you know, if you become a laundry man in there, you can flog the sheets. And I thought, I'll be a laundry man. And I got in their laundry and that, and when I looked at the sheets, everyone's got Littlemore Mental Hospital. And I thought, well, you can't flog them, can you? So I got conned there. People from AA used to come up and do a chair, had a meeting there, but I never went to them because I thought I had enough AA in there. The month was up, and I came out in October. I don't know really when I went in. It might have been August, it might have been July, but I'm not sure. Anyway, I came out on October the 1st, I think, or the 2nd, and I went back to work, and our firm said to me, Mick, we make minerals as well as alcohol. You've got a license to drink as much minerals as you want. Just go up, get a case, and that. So what I used to do, I used to get a dozen pints in the morning. Then evening, I used to get another dozen pints and take home with me. And I used to drink them, and then I'd be up weeing all night. You know, and I got bloaty, and I went up to see a doctor about how fat I got. Well, I was still seeing him anyway. And he said, you've got to go on a diet. I went on a diet, and I didn't go back to AA. The only AA meetings I went to, I took Sylvie with me because she came back. Only temporary, she said. And she came back, and we scoped a little more meeting in the evening. And she came with me because I knew that I couldn't travel from Henley to Littlemore with all the pubs on the way, the bright lights. I didn't drink at work because I thought everyone was spying on me and they wanted my job. I was only a mechanic there, you know, nothing important. And the firm was very good to us. I planned to drink again. It was Christmas Eve. And we had the pub next door open. The brewery did. And everyone was inviting me in. And it was, everyone was inviting me in, and I was saying no. Because I knew if I went in there, and they knew who I was and what I was. If I went in there, I would drink again. Because I knew that I would lace my drink. Not them, I would. So I went home and resentment set in. And I could see them, all them people that only drank 3-4 pints in there. And I thought, why me? Why me an alcoholic? And I thought, I'll drink. So I planned how to drink. I got Sylvie to phone up a man from, a woman from Al-Anon, whose husband went to the meeting, to see if there was a meeting. She phoned her, hung up, said, yes, there's a meeting. So I thought, right, drink before getting on the bus, drink when I get off the bus, go to the meeting, because they tell Sylvie if I'm not there, and then drink after the meeting, drink on the bus, and drink after the bus. Planned. And the phone rang, and it was Bob, a bloke called Bob. And he said, I wasn't going tonight, mate, but I'll come and take you. And I thought, you bastard. And as we were driving to Reading, he said, you've done me a power of good, Mick, you know. You helped me so much in AA. You know, I thought, oh, my head grew, you know, the old ego. And I thought, oh, well, what did I do for you? And he said, I looked at you, and I thought, I don't want to be like you. So I stopped. We got into the room, and everyone said, how are you, Mick? Where have you been? We would have visited you when I told them. And I thought, crikey, these insane people I told lies about and all that. And I looked at them and I thought, I want what you have. And I became willing to go to any lengths for it. And I did. Eve was happier because she used to phone me up every day, you know, and come to meetings with me. No, we used to get picked up. Bob used to come and pick us up, because I didn't have a car then, because that old car, he died. And he used to pick me up and other people and bring us to the meeting. Then after the meeting, take me home. And then one day he said to me, Mick, you should be getting to meetings by yourself. I'll tell you where I am, and you get to the meeting and I'll bring you home. And that was my first bit of effort to get into meetings. I went to, we used to, only two meetings, Wednesday and Friday, used to go there, you know, and always had a meeting on the way back. After a while, they asked me to be a tea person, and I was a tea person for one or two nights, that's all, and they sacked me because they didn't like my tea. And I thought I was doing it so right. I empty the urn, count the tea bags and fill it up with hot water, but they didn't like it, so I got the sack. Eve got me involved in 12-stepping. She'd phone me up and say, Mick, we've got another one, because there was only me and Eve in Henley. And I bought a car, I think Sylv's dad gave us it. And so I used to take Eve, and I used to say to her, Eve, I won't know what to say to the person. I'm only new here, I don't know. I won't know what to say. And she said to me, if I dry up, then you come in. And she could talk for England. You know, she never dry up, but she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And I remember once we went to see a member from Maidenhead who was dying in hospital. And we went over there, and those two were talking about this precious gift, the gift of sobriety. And I thought, if that was me there, I wouldn't be thinking like they're thinking. I'd want a drink. I ain't got much longer, I want to have a drink. And but we went to meetings, Eve and I, all over the place. We went to Bampton once, and Bampton Bill's house. He held his meetings in his house. And we went there, and he'd been dead a year. And Eve didn't know. We drove all the way over to Bampton. I'm trying to think of her name now. Maxine, the daughter. She said, I'm sorry to tell you, but Dad's been dead for a long time. So I said, Eve, what are you doing now then? We're over it. She said, we'd go to Woodstock, the meeting at Woodstock. And I said, Woodstock? And I don't know. Anyway, it was a posh meeting. We went in there. They had furs and diamonds and jewels on. And I said to Eve, Christ almighty, I'm used to wedding, you know. And anyway, as we come out, Eve said, bit posh for us, wasn't it, mate? And I said, it's all right for you, you're posh, I am. But we had wonderful life. All different sorts of people, you know, we saw. And gradually I grew. They made me into a literature person. And I thought, aha, patches, there's strings attached. They're going to ask me questions. So I thought, I better start reading. I've never read books. I started reading the books, all the books. And you know, no one's ever asked me a question about AA. I wouldn't know anyway the answer, you know, but I read the books. And then they said, Mick, they used to put their arm around you. And how's your gratitude? I said, oh, it's great, having a good time, yeah, I love it. Right, you will do this. You wouldn't volunteer, you didn't volunteer. They already had your name the week before. And, you know, and I became a treasurer. So I used to count the money in the meeting, take it home, count it again, put it away. And then at the end of the month, I would get out, me and Sylvie would count it. And if there was too much money in there, I used to take it out. And if it was too little, I put it in. Because I didn't know you had to, the mistakes. I didn't know, you weren't allowed to make mistakes. But how do you learn by your mistakes? And, things got better. You know, at home, I was sober in the meetings, but at home I wasn't. I'd slam doors. If I didn't have my own way, I'd have the huff. I became very demanding because my second illness was addiction to sex. I love sex because I didn't know what it was in those days. And I was very demanding on self. If I wasn't at a meeting, I was in bed, you know. And one day she had two little children, worked hard all day, worked in the evening to get extra cash because we were buying our house. And I was demanding all the time. And, and she said to me one day, Mick, I am not a machine. I just can't turn it on and off as you want it. And what it done for me, it made me... I didn't just learn just like that and say, right, that's it. You know, I kept on still demanding and that. But gradually, I was looking, I was getting the hump. If I couldn't sleep because I was... Randy, I made sure she didn't sleep. I used to toss about just to keep her awake. I didn't just toss and turn over like that. I used to throw myself up in the air, spinning there. You know, all stuff like that. But what it done, it made me start looking of how I was affecting my family. I used to slam doors, rattle cups, you know, all the wrong things to do for a sober person, indoors. And the way I got over it by saying to myself, would you act like this if you had an alcoholic standing behind you? Of course I would. And I used to say that to myself when I used to get home. Jealousy was a great thing. It took me 4 years to sort that out. Possessive jealousy. And I used to make up stories in my head. And I used to believe them. Even to poor old self, you know, wearing stockings, suspenders, you know, all the gear that turned me on for this other man. What other man? She had no time for another man. She was never out of our sight. But he used to keep a friend of the milkman. He was a family friend. I'd be going to work, he'd just be delivering the milk. And I thought, she's upstairs in bed. And I'd joking with him, and I'll get down the road and I'll believe it. I believe the silly story. I was lucky enough to get involved we didn't have a telephone system in Reading then, and I was lucky enough to get involved, or unlucky enough, involved in it. And the committee that formed the phone centre were responsible for all the AA calls. And we used to get called at home, you know. So you were on for so many days, and then someone else, elder person. And then in the end, what we done, we divided up all the area in sections and got the groups involved in doing phone duty. Then I became a secretary after treasurer. And that, I'd go to meetings, I would listen to the chair, and if they were good enough, I would have them at my meeting. If they weren't, they had no chance. Now, I told you that, you know, I was different than all you people. You people read me like a book. You taught me how to be trustworthy. You taught me how to listen. And that was being a secretary, because I had to listen harder to all the chairs to see if you were good enough. And that's how it went on. I became a GSR. Not I didn't want it, and I had to get sent off to intergroup. And it was there was only like Smeaty intergroup, which was in Oxford, and all the AA all around the area used to go to Oxford. Banbury, Wantage, Beaconsfield, we'd all meet up in there and tell how our groups were doing, and I got involved in that, you know, and everything I thought was beyond me, you people got me involved in, and, you know, I grew, Sylvie was in Al-Anon, the people of AA used to tell you, go to open Al-Anon meetings to see how they work, to see how what goes on there. And they're not talking about you, they're talking about how alcoholism affected them. And so Al-Anons were told, go to open AA meetings, because they, to see that your partner or husband, wife, isn't unique. They're all the same as drunks, you know. That he's not special or different. And that's what we were doing. If there was an open Al-Anon, AA people would turn up. If there was an open AA meeting, Al-Anon. I remember once when Henley Group started, the vicar, he used to come every month to the meeting. And he said to me once, I was talking to him, and he said, I wish my parishioners were like you people in AA, so open, it would save so much misery, you know, and things of, you know. He said, because, you know, it is wonderful listening to our alcoholics stay sober. I've never got a person sober in all my life. I take them to a meeting. I show them, get them to meet all the people I know, and that's up to them then, not me. I'll take them anywhere, you know. And, you know, Sylvie and I, we grew side by side, like that. Sometimes we would part, and then we'd come back together. But we grew together. In our house was open house to alcoholics and AA. And the AA people used to come over to have a chat with me. And I start chatting, Sylvie would be there. They love Sylvie to be in the meeting, in there with them. And old Melvin said to her once, we were all chatting away, and he said, ain't that right, Sylvie? And she said, yeah, yeah. Then about 5 minutes later, she said, hold it, Melvin, I ain't one of you. But we had wonderful fun. We had a group of, I've got a group of AAs together, and we used to go all over the place. Conventions, meetings, you know, here where something was happening, and we would be there. Okay. You know, and we just grew and grew, and I think I found out about love in AA. My donut. I found out better than
you.
And anyway, my I met a woman named Tokyo Jin. She was a typical American, all blonde hair, all gold, bangly things. But she spoke in pictures, and I could identify. And I said to her, I love everyone in AA, but I do not like me. And she said, you love no one, Mick. First, you must love yourself. And I had to learn, it wasn't easy, I had to learn to love me. Because when I started thinking about me, I thought about all the past and all the things I'd done. But I did learn to love me. And today I am the best I can be. I might have been a better person yesterday, or maybe tomorrow. But today I am the best I can be. And I found out why I was demanding. Because I had low self-esteem. If I was feeling good, I wasn't demanding. If I was down, I was. But I knew how, learned all about it through this fellowship. I had a sponsor, Eve was my first sponsor, Jacques Lau was my second, and he wouldn't let me get away with nothing. He'd say something to me and I'd say, yes, but, and he'd say, I'm not talking to you. You're trying to get out of it. And it was true. It was true. What's it like today? My life has problems, and big problems. 2 years ago, my world turned upside down. And I didn't know what to do. I told him what's happening. And he grabbed me by my lapels and said firmly, a day at a time, Mick. Keep that. And every time I met him, he would come up to me and say, how are you? How's Sylvie? And I'd tell him, and he'd say, a day at a time. And the man has helped me so much. You know, we our daughter got a partner, and they said that they weren't going to have any children. And I said, we felt, because I love children, weren't going to have any children. And we kind of heartbroken, weren't we, Mark? But we said, that's fine. If that's what it's going to be, that's fine. And anyway, one day they came to us and they said, we've changed our mind, we're trying for a baby. And I thought, oh, wonderful. And then he was born, and it was beautiful. And one day I had him walking around the house, and he was only a little tot, and I had him on my shoulder, and I walked through past our mirror. And I saw him, and I thought, I was all warm inside, wonderful. And I thought, if it wasn't for AA, this wouldn't be happening. And I got involved with that baby. I went to preschool with him and helped look after children and all things like that. And they thought I was an ex-teacher. You know, because I was so good with the children. And I loved it. I loved it. Then she became pregnant again. He was an angel. Then the devil was born. And she was the opposite. And, you know, and this day she was playing with me, and she climbed up behind me, and she hung her arm around me, and she came right in front of me, her head. And I thought, she's going to bite me. She's going to bite me on the nose. And she gave me a kiss. And I melted. The gift of sobriety. you know, all through the meeting and Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to hate the saying, by the grace of God and this fellowship, that I'm sober today. Because all the old members used to say it. It is by the grace of God and this fellowship that I'm sober today. We was out the other day, and a friend of ours, I look after her garden, and she invited us down for the day, down her caravan. And she, we was down there, and something came up that brought the past up. And Sylvie said to her, you know, I left Mick once at one time. And she said, oh, I didn't know that. And she said, but what's happened is that we've learnt to love each other again. And I thought, makes me tears now thinking about it. But that's all thanks to this fellowship, and it's people that's got me sober. All our old friends that Mo mentioned, you know, there was Polish George, there was Donald, who used to come to this meeting, Maura, Melvin, even though Melvin got sober after me, you know, he used to say it's as simple as that, you know, telling people. And he used to run, he had not a penny or a farthing, but he had an old car, and he used to fill it up with women or men and take them all over the place, you know. They didn't have, some of them didn't even want to go, and he'd take them. You know, he was marvellous, Melvin. Yeah, as easy as that, or as simple as that. It was his catchphrase. You know, but I love AA, I love the people in it, and I think it's, you know, I hope I'm here till I keep telling people I'm going to do my 50 years and get a gold watch from AA. I'm going to have it inscribed at the back. I've got to buy it, you know, unless you want to have all club round for me. It's a pocket watch, and it's a Hunter. And, you know, but I am going to, because I have to have something to aim at. With this all, you know, me and Sylve, we planned our retirement, and it all cocked up. But we didn't plan the results. So we've changed the plans now. And we live today, a day at a time. I got involved in Sylve's illness and as a volunteer. And there makes our problems nothing. You know. Because we, as an alcoholic, we can, what was the word for stopped, I can't think of it. Anyway, but they can't, you know, they've got cancer and that, and their life is, you know, shortened. But while we keep going to meetings, I think the word, keep going to meetings and staying sober, like me, I never thought I could do 39 years. Well, I ain't here till Christmas. But I mean, you know, I didn't. I thought I've joined things and left the next day. Because I don't like people organising my life or telling me what to do. No one's told me what to do in AA. They've always suggested. Firmly. Thank you very much for being here and letting me share. Thank you.